And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, one newly recorded, the other from the Morning Show archives that we are replaying in honor of Flag Day coming up this Saturday. Here's part one. Our topic for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show is sound, and specifically noise. When sound becomes unwanted and to some extent even harmful to our well-being, and what can we do about the noise in our world, in our environments, in our buildings, in our office spaces, even in our homes. This and more is explored in a really interesting new book called Clamor: How Noise Took Over the World and How We Can Take It Back, published by W.W. Norton and Company. The author of the book, Chris Burdick, is also author of the book Mind Over Mind, and his writing has appeared in places like Wired, Popular Science, and Politico. Chris Burdick, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Greg, it's great to be here. Thanks a lot.
So tell us what sparked your interest in this particular topic and made you realize that there was a whole book waiting to be written about this really interesting issue.
Sure. Well, I started with an assignment to write about a public health researcher at Harvard. This is for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine, and she was focused on noise as a public health issue. And I hadn't really thought about noise in that way. I thought about it, as many people probably do, as something that bothered me from time to time, and then I forgot about it. So I started to research the epidemiology connected to noise, showing how many impacts it has, not just on our hearing, but how through the stress and the broken sleep from noise, it has impacts on our heart health. It can increase risk of stroke. It can increase risk of hypertension. It has impacts on our mental health and well-being, all of these things. And it struck me how something that could have such impacts on health that people can't even really agree on what it is. So I thought, this is something worth exploring. I decided to write some more stories about different pieces of this, you know, the restaurant noise issue, noise in nature. And I got a grant to go to India and talk to a noise activist there. And it just kept being interesting. I kept finding more pieces of it, which made me think it was worth a book. And I was able to get Norton to agree to that.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad you did, because it is indeed a truly fascinating book. And it is about something that is a part of our lives, a part of our world, and yet something that we don't take the time always to think about, or we don't often think about it in the right way. And in particular, we tend not to think about noise in anticipation of it, but rather in reaction to it after the fact. I think at one point you call this phenomenon sonic neglect, and you say at one point, noise remains a problem regretted in hindsight rather than properly anticipated. And as we read your book, we start to realize that this is true in a lot of different ways. I mean, that what I just read plays out in many different ways in modern life.
Yes, and I think that is a major issue. So we have, you know, typical noise is measured in decibels, and it's something that we wait until it is crossing a threshold of loudness that we then get exercised about it and start to take action against it, wanting it to just shut up. And we don't think about, you know, ahead of time how we could design our indoor spaces or our cities in ways that could help avoid these problems. We will not be in a noise-free world ever, but there are so many noise situations that we kind of blunder into. I can talk about restaurants and how in the 90s the decision was made, in sort of follow trends of getting rid of all of the upholstery and the fuddy-duddy sound-absorbing carpets and other pieces of restaurant design in favor of hard surfaces everywhere. And then, of course, to up the energy, people wanted to bring in the open kitchens right in the middle of everybody eating and you know, crank up the music without thinking ahead of time about what this would do to our ability to actually talk to one another over a meal. And, you know, similar with offices where they decided to knock down all of the walls in order to try to prioritize collaboration, which studies have shown hasn't really happened. But then they didn't think about, well, what would this actually mean for focus on their work when you have this constant jabbering of coworkers in your ear?
Right.
So there's a lot of areas where you just see that people, if they'd given it some thought of prioritizing sound, it might have kind of decreased some of these noisy situations that we are constantly afflicting on each other.
At one point, you utilized the phrase "blundering into cacophony," and and both of those examples that you just gave, you know, really point to that. And the matter of the open concepts that we so often now see in office situations, that open concept, kind of the wide open cubicles and so on, you make a really interesting point in talking about that, which is that if you poll office workers, they will lament the fact that they are in a very noisy environment that undermines their ability to focus, to concentrate, to do their work at the highest level. But you poll the bosses in many of these companies who have a very different sort of office situation where a door closes and they are at least to some extent insulated, and they don't have any serious concerns whatsoever about overly noisy environments and productivity. And it's just, it really points to the fact that often if we are not experiencing something directly, we do a very poor job of understanding what others are experiencing in a maybe very nearby yet utterly different environment.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, right? It's that is for certain. And, you know, I think a lot of progress could be made if we're able to link that sort of individual experience of noise, which, you know, bothers people when they're, you know, have that noise in their ear, with these larger concerns. You know, the studies have started to come out about how when you have these open plan offices, people, the employees are not just complaining about noise, but they are less productive. They take more sick days. They have to leave the office in order to find some quiet time to collect their thoughts. You have to invest now in these you know, new soundproof booths you know, give people a place to focus when they're in these offices. There's a big push now to bring people back to work in the office rather than, you know, work from home or hybrid setups. And, you know, there's resistance to it for many reasons, but one of them being the indoor environment quality, and noise being a big part of that. So if the case can be made better to, you know, link this sort of sonic discomfort, you know, with other pieces of our lives that we want, which is, you know, a productive workforce, you know, a restaurant where we can talk to one another, a hospital where healing is prioritized, then all of those things, you know, circle back in some way to the sound environment. And I think that you can see progress made there in a better way.
Hmm. We're speaking with Chris Burdick about his book, Clamor, How Noise Took Over the World and How We Can Take It Back. One of the points that you make early in the book, when you, among other things, just talk about our sense of hearing and how it works, how the human ear functions and so on, is that you really caution us from making sort of sweeping assumptions or generalizations about what the problems are when we think about noise intruding into our lives, and that this is not just about loudness. I mean, that in and of itself can be a very, very serious problem, but that does not completely tell the story of how this can be a really serious issue. Talk for a moment about that tendency for us to focus on the loudness piece of this when there are other things we need to consider as well.
Right, and it's a fine line because we consider loudness first and foremost because there is a very handy metric, the decibel, that simplifies this world of noise, this vast world of noise, into a number that can be measured by an instrument, a decibel meter. And because of its simplicity, it's very useful, but it can be over-relied on. Loudness, decibels, you know, they measure the acoustic intensity of a sound. And the realm of the world's noise where that matters exclusively is 3 centimeters long, and that's the length of the average human cochlea in the inner ear. That's where this sound intensity can damage, you know, the structures of the inner ear and cause hearing harm. Beyond that, you start to get into areas where sound does not need to be very loud to cause us distress. So the research on sleep, for instance, shows that noise from transportation, roadways, airplanes, etc., starts to lead to disturbed sleep at around 45 decibels. When you're sleeping, your ears stay open, your eyes close, but your ears are always on guard, and they're on guard for any kind of a threat. And the sounds of transportation coming in will lead to kind of a perking up of your central nervous system. Your heart rate, which kind of slows down when you sleep, will start to speed up again. Blood pressure will rise. Your stress hormones will begin to flow again. And this happens frequently, naturally, during sleep. You don't wake up, but this sort of just happens. But when you have noise, it happens in a chronic way. And that kind of chronic response is what can, you know, increase hardening of your arteries and clogging of your arteries and dysregulation of your stress response even after you wake up. Mm. So that's one way that, you know, decibels don't quite cover what is going on here. This is not just the sort of loudness that we think of when we're going to like a rock concert or in industry where we have to protect our ears. This is a different mechanism.
Right. You're right. Once we move beyond the cochlea and into the brain, noise becomes a much different, more complex problem, one that decibel counts often misconstrue. And by the way, you point out an interesting statistic at some point in the book when it comes to things like loud rock concerts, I mean ear-splittingly loud rock concerts, that Americans do tend to poo-poo the notion of ear protection, and that only a very small percentage of Americans who attend such events do anything at all to protect their ears from the sonic assault that they are about to experience. And it's interesting to think about different cultures who can inadvertently fuel a sort of indifference or a sense of invulnerability. I guess it's you tell us that there are a couple of reasons why we tend to be sometimes careless about the precious sense of hearing, a couple of mistaken assumptions that people make about how this happens, including the whole matter of old age. Can you just talk for a moment about that, about why we tend to be careless about this?
Yeah, so there is some loss of hearing that happens naturally as we age, and all the hearing researchers that I spoke to couldn't give me a definitive breakdown of, you know, how much is lost due to old age versus how much is lost due to noise exposure. For one big reason, which is that it's really hard to track for any individual living a life today how much noise they are exposed to. You can measure it at specific industries, but you know, you don't measure it when they are listening to music on their devices. You don't measure it when they are going out to the bar with their friends. You just can't capture how much actual noise people are exposed to. So there's kind of a black box there. But they do know from discrete research on both animals and humans that, you know, noise at certain decibel levels will start to break down the inner ear anatomy, the hair cells, and then below that, the nerve connections that transmit what is just sent, you know, vibrations through the air, and turn it into a signal that your brain can understand as all the sounds that we need and enjoy in our lives. So some happens over aging, and people tend to think of it as like, well, why should I worry about losing my hearing when I you know, it's going to happen. I can't do anything about it. It's like wrinkles or graying hair. This is not something to get all bothered about when I'm 40 years old or 30 years old or 20. So that's part of it. It's this kind of feeling like it's going to happen anyway, and it's not. You know, you can look at the research on mice and see how they expose some mice to 2 hours of noise. And then, you know, mice live for a couple of years, and they showed that after just 2 hours of noise, these mice had damage to the nerve connections between their inner ear and their auditory nerve, twice as much damage as the naturally aging mice did that did not have that 2 hours, only 2 hours of noise exposure. So, you know, that's a big part of it, I think.
Mm. And, of course, you also point out in the same portion of the book that because hearing loss tends to be incremental, I mean, it is also something in which we tend not to be vividly aware of it. It's a loss that happens bit by bit, again, usually, and we tend to be rather unaware of such losses in our life, whatever we're talking about, but particularly with something like this. I also want to make sure I give you a moment to talk about something that really astonished me, and then the more I thought about it, the more it made perfect sense. And that is when we're talking on kind of a larger scale about whole cities that are exceptionally noisy and cause harm to their citizens. You point out quite rightly that we tend to think of this as a predominantly American phenomenon in big cities like Chicago and New York and Los Angeles and so on. But you point out that actually the most serious metropolitan noise issues happen in, for instance, the large cities of Asia or Africa, in part because of the way and the haste in which many of these huge cities have been constructed, with people, in a sense, kind of piled right on top of one another. And you describe soundscapes that really sound truly alarming for the people who have to live in those environments.
Yeah, I mean, that's so you have, I was in India for a couple of weeks, and I was at one of these cities outside of Mumbai called Ulhasnagar, and it had been singled out by a research group in India as having the noisiest daytime ambient sound levels just from traffic and honking. And it, I think, averaged about 91 decibels, 91, which is, just to give you a sense of things, the OSHA requirements here in the States start to require manufacturer industries to give employees noise protection at 85 decibels, or hearing protection at 85 decibels. So this is just people living their lives with 91 decibels cranking through the streets. And part of the problem, as you mentioned, is the haste in which these cities were built with very little zoning. So you have just manufacturing and residents and industry and businesses, schools, hospitals. They're all just in the same places. You have too many, the streets aren't big enough or well designed enough to deal with all of the vehicular traffic. And so what happens is, a lot of drivers in India will just honk their horns because people have to, you know, they have to walk in the street. There's people in the street. They're just sort of honking their horns to say, I'm about to turn left or something. And so it has this cascading impact when everybody is crammed on top of one another and things are not planned out well enough to handle them. That ratchets up the volume.
Mm.
So a lot of these cities in Asia and in India and in Africa have that problem.
Right. Well, I hasten to add that your book is not just about the problem, but also about the many potential solutions that are out there. In fact, I love the subtitle of the second part of your book, which is A Better Sounding World. And you talk about some of the intriguing innovations in design in terms of entire neighborhoods, even entire cities designed with a healthier soundscape in mind. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And I hope you can also tell us about the interesting innovations proposed by one Yoko Sen, a sound designer and composer who found herself hospitalized. And we don't often think of hospitals as places where there is all kinds of unwanted and potentially harmful noise. And only when she was hospitalized did they realize just the extent of this problem. And there are really intriguing possibilities there for making that particular environment far healthier than it is right now in terms of sound.
Sure. I mean, I'll take it, I guess, one at a time. I might start, if I may, with an indoor soundscape. So when I talk about this approach here, I talk about it as a soundscape approach. And so one instance I like to talk about is a restaurant that was put into the atrium at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And all those things I mentioned earlier about how restaurants wanted hard surfaces and music and, you know, kitchens that were open, this restaurant wanted all those things. And the atrium that it was being put into is a giant glass box. It's about, you know, three stories tall with stone floors and tons of traffic around it because it's an interchange between different pieces of the museum where, you know, the families have just been released from the, you know, the quiet enforcement of an art gallery, and now they are going to lunch. 500 people or so are fit into this place. It has all the makings of a horrible acoustic experience, but if you go there, you'll notice that it is actually quite easy to talk to people as you eat your meal. And the reason is because when it was designed, they took advantage of a kind of newer technology that allows for an immersive modeling of a planned building, what it's going to sound like. This model, you take what's called an impulse response measure, and that's just sort of based on what the layout is and the materials, how sound is going to bounce around the space. And then you put those sounds in. You have sounds of people eating or the sounds of the dishes and the music, and you pump those in, and then you create this model where people can sit in it, and you say, is this what you want? is this the end product? And if they say, well, no, that's crazy, no, we have to shout at each other, then you start to add different sound absorption and materials, and you say, how about now? You know, and the goal is not to create this sort of mausoleum or library quiet area where people will hear each other slurping their soup and overhear conversation. You want to have that kind of lively buzz. This is, again, where we come into where decibels are not the best measure of what you want in a sound environment. You want that lively buzz that you is sort of a background churn of people talking, but not so loud that you can't have a comfortable conversation over it. And when you reach that point, then you know that you've designed the place well. So that is, I think, a real key, you know, use of technology now that we have that could be, put to much wider use in our designing of our interior spaces.
Right. You at one point call that, I think, the art and science of adding sound to fight noise.
That's right. That's right. And that's an office approach as well. You know, you have to be really careful. It's not the people I talk about. We're trying to put some sort of nature sounds as part of a sound masking system in an office. And, you know, one big natural sound that people love when they're actually in nature is birds. But these folks realize quickly that just adding random chirping birds to an office space would really annoy people, you know, because you had to put it on this loop, and it's like catching their attention all the time when they're trying to do their work. So it's an art and a science. But I could talk about Yoko Sen or talk about urban approaches either way. I don't want to monopolize the time here.
Whatever you think. I mean, I think both are really interesting. Maybe talk about Yoko Sen and then just entice our listeners with a brief thought about the other matter when it comes to putting our cities together.
Sure. So Yoko Sen is a musician who found herself hospitalized for some time, and she had she thought about sound a lot as a musician. She had read an article that from neuroscientists suggesting that the last sense to go before we die is our hearing. And when she was lying there, the sounds that she was continuously hearing were these alarms and beeps from the monitors that she was attached to and other patients were attached to that just never stopped. She thought, is this what's going to be my final send-off, these beeps? And in fact, one time, the alarms were beeping just so shrilly that her husband asked the nurse, what's going on here? Is there a problem? Is my wife in trouble? And the nurse nonchalantly said, no, that just beeps. Don't worry about it. And so she realized that, this environment was not conducive to healing for the patients. It was a disturbing environment for getting rest. And it also was an environment where these beeps, which were meant to be helping clinicians, recognize the status of their patients and if there was an emergency, they weren't doing their job. These were just machines that beeped as far as they were concerned. And so she just decided that she wanted to kind of dedicate her life, or at least a part of her professional life, to improving the soundscapes of hospitals. And she started to give talks about this, about, the last sound that people want to hear, et cetera, what these beeps should do and what they are doing to the environment. And it was one of her talks was in the audience was a designer of a product from Philips that make a lot of patient monitors. And he said, oh, that's really interesting. Let's take a look at our patient monitors and the alarms that we have. We've put millions and millions of dollars of R&D into these machines to improve everything about them over the years. Where did the sounds come from? And he traced them back to a cassette tape from 1981. So this kind of, again, goes to this sonic neglect where the sounds are the last thing that people prioritize a lot of time. So they worked, Philips and Yoko Sen worked together to try to recreate or re-envision what the sounds of the machines should be. And it started with her asking clinicians, let's listen to these sounds. If they were a person, what would they be to you? And people said, oh, they'd be a drill sergeant. They'd be my nagging mother-in-law. They'd be a toddler that just won't leave me alone. They'd be a boss who's chastising me. And said, well, what do you want these sounds to be like for you? Well, we want them to be a colleague. We want them to be interested in helping the patient and helping us help the patient. And so they went through rounds and rounds of kind of using sonic elements to change these beeps into something that were less shrill, less insistent. These are sort of psychoacoustic changes that they made, and then they would test them again and again. And over the process of doing this, they have created whole new sounds for the suite of Philips patient monitors. But that's just one company. There's a whole array of things that need to be addressed at the hospital level to kind of tame what we would call the alarm fatigue problem in the wards.
Fascinating.
Okay, so yeah. It's on the urban level, it's hard because it's not like a contained restaurant space or a hospital space. You have many different sources of noise that are beyond your control to address. And you also have to deal with the fact that different parts of the city will be served by different soundscapes. So if you have a park in the city, you want to think about, well, what's the job of this park? The job of the park is, in many cases, it's not going to be the same all the time, but it's going to be to give people a place to recreate, a place to relax, a place to socialize with one another when they're done with work or at lunchtime, a place for nature to have a spot in the city. And the people I talked to were trying to come up with a way to use artificial intelligence to give urban designers a way to predict, again, to think ahead of time when they're designing a park or adding or changing the city streets around that park, what the soundscape effect will be from these changes. And then you say, well, let's say, does that effect match what you want? Is that something that is going to be doing the job that you want this piece of the city to do? It could be a park, it could be an urban plaza, it could be a business district. The need is there to come up with a way to go beyond just the decibel, that simple number, and come up with something that is maybe not as simple as a single number, but is also workable for urban designers. So it's not like every single project has to be this sort of bespoke, unique approach that takes them out of their comfort zone as professionals. So that's a big challenge, but like the approach is there, the proof of concept is there. It's just making it scalable that is the challenge now.
I'm just curious, as you just walk around living your life day to day, how much do you find your awareness of the sounds around you, the noise around you in your various environments, how much has your awareness of that been dramatically heightened just by the way in which you have immersed yourself in this really interesting topic?
Yeah, it has heightened it. It's heightened it because I go to a restaurant now and I think about it when it's... I was just at a restaurant the other day where it was too quiet, and I thought about, well, how could we... I started thinking about solutions, the real quick ones. Well, maybe you could add a bit of background music here, or I go to a restaurant that's way too loud, and I think, you know, it would be pretty easy for you to address this if you wanted to, if you prioritize conversation. And I go to a new park that they just put up in my town, which is outside Boston. This park is on an overpass that goes over a sort of large interstate, kind of cuts the town in half, essentially. And the place used to be this eyesore of concrete, and they put in all kinds of trees and pathways and kind of nice faux gas lighting structures, and it's a pretty beautiful spot now, but nobody goes there. And part of the problem is that not only is there a highway underneath it, but around it there are busy streets that cause a ton of noise. There's nothing in the park, like with a berm or larger trees or high back seating or anything like that, maybe a water feature that would help to mask and create a different kind of sound, what we call like an audio island there, that makes it relaxing. And so it's this beautiful kind of abandoned spot. And I think about that. I think about, you know, in many situations when the sound environment doesn't suit the purpose of a place, that's when I really take notice.
Well, your book certainly does a marvelous job of getting all of us to think more about the world of sound all around us, in our daily lives, in our homes, in our workplaces, in the places we go. And it gets us thinking, of course, about the way in which we can build a better world in terms of sound. The book, again, is Clamor, How Noise Took Over the World and How We Can Take It Back, published by W.W. Norton & Company. The author, Chris Burdick. Chris Burdick, thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book. And thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Oh, I appreciate it. You asked terrific questions.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, in anticipation of Flag Day, which is this coming Saturday, we are replaying an interview recorded and initially broadcast back in 2014. And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be looking back at the dramatic moment in American history when the Star-Spangled Banner was penned by Francis Scott Key. My guest is Steve Vogel, a reporter with the Washington Post and the author of a fascinating book that was published in 2014 in the 200th anniversary year of the Star-Spangled Banner. The book is called Through the Perilous Fight, From the Burning of Washington to the Star-Spangled Banner, The 6 Weeks That Saved a Nation, published by Random House. Steve Vogel, we welcome you to the morning show.
I'm glad to be here.
I am so glad that this book has been written, in part because I think many Americans, and I count myself among them, know very little about the War of 1812. Can you tell us, in general, what are the circumstances which set that war in motion, and why that war was fought in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. It's often been forgotten what the causes of that war were. But it's important to remember, first of all, that the United States declared war on Great Britain and not the other way around. You know, sometimes people assume that Great Britain was trying to retake the colonies. And really, this war should be seen as an offshoot of the much larger conflict that was going on in Europe. The Great War between Great Britain and France that had been raging for about 20 years. And with the rise of Napoleon in France, Great Britain was fighting what it saw as a war for survival, not only for itself, but really for civilization. And Napoleon was in command of much of continental Europe by 1812. So in pursuing their war aims, Great Britain did not hesitate to trample on American sovereignty to make sure that they had the sailors they needed for sailing their ships. For example, they stopped American ships at sea, and anybody they suspected of being of British origin, they would take off and put to work on the Royal Navy. They would impress them, and you know, essentially it was a form of kidnapping. And Great Britain was also blocking American trade with the continent. So President Madison, by 1812, had come to the conclusion that if the United States were to allow this to continue, we might as well not have won our independence a generation earlier, that you know, we were really just a vassal state. And so in June of 1812, by a very narrow margin, Congress declared war, and the nation was very divided on this issue.
So one of the iconic moments, of course, from the War of 1812 is the burning of Washington. And your book is a valuable way for us to understand, maybe better than we otherwise would, just the level of national trauma which that represented. Just tell our listeners a bit more about, in a sense, symbolically, and also in fact, in point of fact, what the burning of Washington represented at that point in our young nation's history.
Well, this was a very dangerous and very low moment in United States history, and we sometimes today forget just how precarious it was and how close the nation was to collapse. But, you know, the British, after waging this war without full strength for the first 2 years, after Napoleon's abdication in April of 1814, they send more force over to the United States to try to put an end to this war and really make sure the United States would never again be in a position to declare a war like this. They were hoping to really, if not collapse the country, leave us in a very weakened state. And so the capture of Washington was a very bold operation by that was dreamed up by Admiral George Coburn. And once the Army troops arrive under the command of General Ross, he is persuaded to give this a try. The idea for the British was really to force the United States to so humiliate the government, to force them to make peace on British terms, and perhaps force the collapse of the American government. And after defeating militia forces that were set up outside Washington at Blaytonsburg 200 years ago on August 24th, 1814, the British had an open path to the city, and they moved in and began burning that night the Capitol, the White House,
Really, every federal building save one was destroyed. The Washington Navy Yard was put up into flames by the Americans themselves to keep it from falling into British hands. President Madison and his government are forced to flee. You know, there's no Air Force One to whisk him away. This was a very precarious moment in American history. And the events that follow in Baltimore 3 weeks later are going to be so critical to turning it around.
One of the points of studying or challenges of studying something like this, that is the burning of Washington and also the circumstances under which Francis Scott Key saw that flag bravely flying the morning after that bombardment on Baltimore and Fort McHenry, so much legend, so much myth has sprung up. In fact, just ahead of a patriotic recital, which I just sang where I teach in honor of this anniversary, I was sent by a couple of different people links to various little video montages about the Star-Spangled Banner, and I could just tell from watching them that they were just soggy with myth about what in fact had occurred. And I should think for you as a historian trying to write a serious treatment of these events, it must be a tricky challenge to make your way through all of that and figure out what in fact happened.
You're right. I mean, there are a lot of myths surrounding this story. You know, and the thing is, the real story doesn't need embellishment. I mean, the what actually happened is certainly dramatic enough, and in many cases is a lot more interesting than some of these myths. You know, some of the myths have a little bit of root in truth, but you know, going through the records as I did, and the letters and documents, both of the British and the Americans involved, and Francis Scott Key himself, I think I was able to put together a very specific chronological account that details the burning of Washington and the mission that Francis Scott Key launches to rescue an American doctor who is held prisoner by the British, and then the chain of circumstances that leave him in this unique position to watch the bombardment and attack of Baltimore.
Mm. I think one of the trickiest matters is to understand the kind of real peril that Fort McHenry faced in this bombardment versus what it appeared to be to somebody like Francis Scott Key, who was an observer right there. And I'm sure all these years after the fact, it's not easy to understand or to determine with absolute certainty just what occurred. I mean, in the chaos of battle, it can be difficult to know even in the moment what exactly occurred. But what is our best understanding of the peril that was faced by Fort McHenry on that dramatic night?
Sure. Now, the British were very interested in destroying Baltimore. This was the third largest city in the nation at the time, a very important commercial port, and also a center of a lot of the privateering attacks, the private merchant ships that are armed that were attacking British commercial vessels. So whereas in Washington, they had burned the federal buildings, but really left private property alone. Baltimore, they were going to teach a different lesson to. Now, 3 weeks after the fall of Washington, you know, the nation is kind of teetering on the brink here. There's fear that if Baltimore falls, Philadelphia and New York won't be far behind. There was, quite a bit of panic in the country, and, you know, the U.S. Treasury was absolutely broke. Banks from New York to South were not accepting U.S. Paper currency anymore. There was a real possibility that if Baltimore falls, the nation is just going to fall apart. So the stakes were very high, and Francis Scott Key was well aware of them when he was watching the bombardment. He, ironically, was very much an opponent of this war. He had just considered it very foolhardy for the United States to take on one of the world's great powers, and he had been outraged that the United States had attacked Canada, which was then known as British North America, as part of its war strategy. They were trying to take Canadian territory to use as bargaining chips with the British. So he had thought the war was a bad idea to start with and feared it would, you know, bring desolation and destruction to the nation, and he feared that's exactly what he was going to witness when he was watching the attack on Fort McHenry.
Did he almost witness that? I mean, how close were we to defeat in this instance?
We were certainly close on this occasion. The British had a two-pronged attack, and they had landed the army troops at North Point, a peninsula leading to Baltimore. And that was sort of the first phase of the attack. And then the bombardment ships, which had names like Devastation, Terror, Meteor, gives you an idea of the British intent, worked their way up the Patapsco River to position themselves off Fort McHenry to start the bombardment. Some important things had happened in the 3 weeks since Washington was burned. One was that the shock of that attack had rallied a lot of militia from Pennsylvania, from Maryland, from Virginia, to march to Baltimore, which was believed to be the next point of British attack. So in the intervening weeks, some 15,000 militia had been positioned in a very well-fortified dug-in hill overlooking the approach that the British would be taking to Baltimore. And a lot of defenses were set up around Fort McHenry, including vessels which were sunk across the mouth of the harbor to protect the city. And you also had some very key naval figures come into the city, John Rogers and Oliver Hazard Perry, David Porter. These were some of the great heroes and names in the U.S. Navy to take over some of the defenses and have their crews man guns to protect the fort. So the city has time, because of British delays, to build up their defenses. And this was to prove very vital when the British launched their attack 200 years ago.
Well, needless to say, Baltimore survived, Fort McHenry survived, the flag survived. And your book goes on, of course, to chronicle a bit more about the writing of these memorable words and the process by which it eventually became our national anthem. Your book also talks about the ongoing efforts to preserve the actual flag that flew over Fort McHenry. All of this amazing story told in the book through the perilous fight, from the burning of Washington to the Star-Spangled Banner, 6 weeks that saved a nation, published by Random House. Steve Vogel, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and for writing this important book.
It was my pleasure.
We want to remind you that Flag Day is coming up this Saturday, and one way you can celebrate is by joining the Kenosha Pops, a band, for their first concert of this summer of 2025, a concert at 2 o'clock at Kenosha's Civil War Museum. This concert is free and open to the public. It's exactly 8:59. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am excited to welcome to our program Greta Neubauer, who is Wisconsin State Representative, representing the 66th Wisconsin Assembly District. And then on Thursday, Kaylin Palomares and her monthly visit to The Morning Show. With her will be Judy Cardine from Wisconsin DNR, talking about bumblebees. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our skies today will be mostly sunny, and we are headed for a high today of 77 degrees, warmer into the mid to upper 80s for a daytime high tomorrow. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha Receiver.